So our first case for argument, United States v. Hamilton. Mr. Camarena?
Good morning, Your Honors. Government counsel, may it please the court. My name is Paul Camarena, and I am the court-appointed appellate attorney for Leslie John Hamilton. The first issue that this honorable court is asked to decide is whether a filing which is entitled Government Proposed Jury Instructions and which was signed exclusively by government counsel was somehow submitted by the defendant, Leslie John Hamilton. A bit of procedural history, Your Honors. The district court instructed the parties in this case to submit a final joint pretrial report, which would include proposed jury instructions. The parties did submit a final pretrial report, and attached to that report, government proposed jury instructions and also defendants proposed jury instructions. Mr. Hamilton now challenges some of the instructions that were included in the government proposed jury instructions. However, in the appellee's brief, the government asserts that because the government proposed jury instructions were included as part of a joint final pretrial report, somehow Mr. Hamilton himself requested those instructions, and therefore he waived the issue and this court is prohibited from reviewing any challenges to those jury instructions. The government's position on this issue is inconsistent with the procedural history of this case. Mr. Hamilton objected to some of the jury instructions that were included in the government proposed jury instructions. Mr. Hamilton would submit that it would be nonsensical for a party to object to their own proposed jury instructions. If they had an objection to their own proposed jury instructions, they would simply have not had submitted those proposed jury instructions. It was the court's understanding, as well as the party's understanding, that the parties would submit a joint pretrial report and submit, as part of that joint report, separate government proposed jury instructions that were signed exclusively by government counsel and also defendants proposed jury instructions that were signed exclusively by defense counsel. Therefore, Mr. Hamilton has not waived the issue, and this court can review the error. Mr. Hamilton acknowledges that because he did not object to the challenge jury instruction in the district court, this court will review that jury instruction for a plain error. Nevertheless, Mr. Hamilton believes that jury instruction was plain error because it was inconsistent with the case law handed down by this court. In the United States versus...
So what is the instruction you want?
The instruction that Mr. Hamilton challenges is an instruction that...
What is the instruction you want?
Your Honor, it wasn't so much an instruction that Mr. Hamilton would have requested as much as a challenge to an instruction that was given.
Well, you've got to have an alternative.
Your Honor, it would be our position that the alternative would have been to not give an instruction on this issue at all.
On what issue?
On the issue of intent.
Not have an instruction on an intent in a criminal case?
Well, Your Honor, this was a fraud prosecution, and the court instructed the jury to disregard, or that it was irrelevant whether the defendant had intended to repay the alleged victims in this case. Mr. Hamilton would submit...
Well, that's certainly true.
Well, Mr. Hamilton...
Steal someone's money. You can't say, well, I just stole it because I wanted to invest it, and after I did that, I would return the principal to my victim.
Well, Your Honor, there...
You're not arguing that, are you?
There is case law that supports the position that an intention to repay the victims is a valid...
I don't think so.
If I may direct the court's attention to a case from this court, United States versus Bessison. In that case, this court...
What court? What case?
It was the United States versus Bessison, which was cited...
Yeah, that's a check-kiting case, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, well, with check-kiting, you don't have check-kiting if you think that you're going to have money in your account to pay. Then it's just an overdraft. That's not the same as a fraud where you defraud people of money and then you hope that you might be able to repay them at some future time.
Your Honor, the charge in that case was the exact same charge as the charges in the United States versus Hamilton. So the elements of the offense would have been the same. And
No, but you know what kiting is. So kiting, you're writing a check, you know you can't cover it, but on the other hand, but you're going to write the check into another account, and then you're going to check out of that account. You know, you go back and forth. Now, if you actually think that there's money in those accounts, or that they'll be put money, or that money will, you'll put real money into the account before the check is presented for collection, then you're not defrauding the bank or anybody. But you don't have that here.
You know, there's been a subsequent case after Bessesen where the court suggested that an intent to defraud would have been defeated had the defendant actually paid the alleged victims in that case.
Well, that can't be right. What if you embezzle money from your employer to gamble with, and you think you're lucky that you're going to win your bet and you're going to be able to repay the employer, and in that event, if you have the money, you will repay the employer? Is that a defense to embezzlement, do you think?
Your Honor, following the cases, United States...
Do you think that's a defense to embezzlement?
Your Honor, I...
Do you?
I think that...
Do you? Yes or no?
Yes, under the case law, Your Honor.
Oh, then you're... No. Then you're completely wrong.
Also, what evidence, record, or in your brief that support that the evidence in the record...
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear that question.
What evidence... Is there in the trial record that would support your theory that you had enough money in the bank? Or do you have to send forth your brief?
Mr. Hamilton, the defendant in this case, testified in this case, and he testified on several occasions that he didn't have the intent to defraud the alleged victims, that he always intended to pay back the victims. We would submit that under the case law that this court has handed down, beginning with the United States versus Bennison and continuing with the United States versus Pritchard, that would have defeated, had the jury accepted that testimony, an intent to defraud. Nevertheless, the district court in this case instructed the jury to disregard that it was irrelevant whether Mr. Hamilton intended to repay the victims.
That it?
Your Honor, of course, plain error would only exist if there were error and it was plain, and substantial rights would have been affected by this error. I would submit that the error in this case was plain because it is inconsistent with the previous holding by this court, both in the United States versus Bennison and the United States versus Pritchard, that an intent to repay the victims is a valid defense. In this case, the defendant, Mr. Hamilton, testified that he did intend to pay the victims, that he never intended to defraud them. Nevertheless, the district court gave instructions that were plainly inconsistent with the case, with the cases handed down by this circuit. We'd also submit that error affected substantial rights. In the United States versus Riviera, this court held that a jury instruction affects substantial rights if it had the serious potential to affect the outcome of the case. We would submit that had the jury accepted Mr. Hamilton's testimony that he intended to repay the victims and that he did not intend to defraud them, and had the district court not instructed the jury to disregard, or that it was irrelevant whether Mr. Hamilton intended to repay the victims, there certainly would have been the potential that the juror would have found that Mr. Hamilton did not have the intention to defraud the victims, and it could have had the potential to affect the outcome of this case. Of course, even if all three elements of plain error review are satisfied, this court will not exercise its discretion to correct a plain error unless the error seriously affects the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings. We would submit that a plain error, which could have resulted in an illegal sentence of 300 months in prison, would affect the public reputation and the fairness and integrity of a judicial proceeding. I see that my time is close to running out, so unless Your Honors have additional questions, I will reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Camarena. Ms. Kraft?
Morning, Your Honors. My name is Carol Kraft. I'm an Assistant United States Attorney from the Eastern District of Wisconsin. I was also the trial attorney for this case. I think it's important to be clear from the outset that the defendant now objects to a single phrase of a portion of a jury instruction which was given as part of the scheme to defraud definition to the jury. That phrase is, regardless, he claims that the district court instructed the jury that a scheme to defraud could be established regardless of whether the defendant hoped, intended, or even expected that the victims would eventually be satisfied. Now, that's not the entire sentence that is part of the instruction that's at dispute. What the court instructed the jury was that if money or property is obtained through knowingly false representations, the scheme to defraud is established regardless of whether the defendant hoped, intended, or even expected that the victims could eventually be satisfied. It is our position that that's a correct statement of the law, but the court doesn't have to get to that analysis because, in fact, the defendant waived his right to object to this instruction by his actions at the district court level. He had several opportunities to object to this instruction. I think it's also important to note that this was not a theory of defense instruction that he submitted that the court declined to give in the way that he submitted it. It was part of an instruction submitted by the United States as part of the package of instructions in the case. The defendant first had an opportunity to object to this instruction following the at the time of the joint pretrial report that was required by the court. Judge Stagmiller required that the parties meet prior to trial. There was a written order to that effect and discuss pretrial issues, including jury instructions. He instructed that the parties should attempt to agree on substantive instructions, but if the parties could not agree, they were to file a written statement of what was in dispute and some type of legal memorandum, or if appropriate, an offer of proof to support their individual positions with respect to the disputed instructions. The parties did that March 25th, consistent with the court's order. A joint pretrial report was filed. In that joint pretrial report, both sides identified those particular instructions to which they objected. The phrase that the defendant now objects to was part of the government's proposed instruction number 15. The defense, neither Mr. Hamilton nor the person who was his co-defendant at that time, she was still in the case, Ms. Roebuck, neither of them objected to this particular instruction. They objected to a number of the other...
I don't understand the difference. So you say this was a waiver, but rather than a forfeiture, and so plain error doesn't apply. Is that your argument?
That's exactly our position, Judge.
Well, but what... It wasn't his instruction, right?
It wasn't his instructions,
but... It wasn't joint instructions. It was your instructions,
no,
right?
In effect, it was a joint instruction.
In effect, is very slippery.
Well, because he did not object. He joined the instruction.
Go to the merits of it and not fuss over what the difference between a waiver and a forfeiture.
Well, because I think the court has held, and it's very clear, that waiver does.
I know, but all you're saying is if you don't object to the instructions, it's a waiver. It sounds more like a forfeiture to me.
Okay, well, I believe that under Griffin, United States versus Griffin, this court held that the right to object on appeal is waived when the record illustrates that the defendant approved the instruction at issue.
Yes, but you treat a failure to object as approval. As I say, if it was his instruction or if it was listed as joint instructions, fine, but it's your instructions and he didn't object. So,
well, there's more, Judge.
Why does that mean he... I think that erases the line between waiver and forfeiture.
Well, if I could just say there's more. On April 1st, there was a final pretrial, and the court directed the parties to meet and discuss the disputed instructions and
That's just another way of saying they didn't object to the instructions. You could have asked them to say, let's call these joint instructions, right? You could have done that. You didn't do that.
I understand the court's point. It's still my position that he waived it. I think the entire record supports a waiver. However, even if the court...
What that means, entire record supports.
Well, the rest of the...
Discussing the adequacy of the instruction, we get tied in knots over looking at the entire record to see whether the issue is presented.
All right. Well, I understand the court's position. It remains my position that it was a waiver and that the court should consider it as such. However, if the court decides not to do that, there was no plain error here. There was no error at all. The instruction that the court given is a legally accepted instruction. It has been approved by this court multiple times. It has been approved by this court in United States versus Maybach, United States versus Alexander, United States versus Dunn. The essence is that somebody's hope that they can repay somebody at a later time once they have defrauded that person is not a defense. And this was not even Mr. Hamilton's theory of defense. Mr. Hamilton's theory of defense was that he was somehow a negligent businessman who didn't pay enough attention to what his sales agents was doing and didn't really realize that, in fact, he owed all this money. The record is very clear that that defense had no merit whatsoever in the evidence. The evidence was abundantly clear that he made multiple misrepresentations about investors' money and what he was to do with that investor's money.
Whether after the March or the May meeting, did there come a time when you appeared in court with defense counsel to make the record on the instructions before the district judge?
Yes.
And did the district judge go instruction by instruction, not reading them, let's say, but just numerically, and call upon counsel to respond?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what will the record tell us? What was recorded in the record as to when this numbered instruction was called by the district judge in open court on the issue of approval or disapproval?
Well, I can't tell the court that the court articulated the instructions by number. I can tell the court that on April 26th, there was a jury instruction conference following the close
on
of the evidence.
Record.
On the record. Following the close of the evidence in that case. And at that jury instruction conference, the judge provided to the attorneys for the parties the copies of the instructions that he intended to give. It included this instruction that's at dispute now.
Okay. Is that Judge Stadtmuller's practice to just give the packet that he's decided will be offered in this case?
Yes.
What does the record say about the adoption of all or and every instruction that was given?
The record reflects that we discussed the instruction, that he asked for input from counsel as to their positions on the instructions. The instruction that we're talking about is part of Part 2, which is the substantive instructions in this case. The defendant, Mr. Hamilton, objected to some of the language and some of the instructions that were in that packet. He objected to the language in the lulling instruction. He said that he did not believe...
What did he say about the other instructions?
He did not object to anything else. Judge Stadtmuller...
Did he say, I approve them, I agree with them, they're correct, or what?
Well, Judge Stadtmuller asked him if he had anything else or any other objections, and he said no.
So he said he had no objections, he didn't say he approved them. The judge could have asked him, do you approve of these instructions?
The judge could have asked him, but
the judge ask him that. Then you could have your waiver in a little nicely wrapped package.
Sure, and perhaps next time, Judge, I will ask the judge to ask the...
But how many instructions were given, Ms. Graff? Just number. Aren't they all numbered?
I don't know that they're numbered
When you have your final discussion before the judge.
Right.
The parties are clear on what is to be given, and they are the court's instructions at the point that both parties agree. There are no prosecution and defense instructions if they're adopted by the court and submitted, I mean, in the sense that eventually they go to the jury that way.
That's correct.
I just don't I'm not clear, and I haven't read the record. What happens instruction by instruction? They each have to be approved, unless you have some kind of group approval up in this setting here. I don't know. I mean, I'm reaching back kind of dated to when I used to do this.
Right.
But I went through each instruction and called for a verbal response from both sides.
And Judge Stadmiller didn't do that. But he did give out the instructions in advance. He had the parties review them. And then we had a discussion about which instructions were acceptable.
So you're saying by implication, if in the dialogue that occurred in this case, if there is, when the district judge says, are there any objections, it's incumbent upon both sides to specifically mention that particular one. Otherwise, it's presumed the packet or the total number of instructions are accepted?
Yes, I believe
that. Well, I would urge some reflection upon an instruction-by-instruction approach, because it would really, takes just a few moments, even in a multi-defendant trial, to go through each instruction.
I see my time is up.
Just to pursue Judge Flom's question for one sec, doesn't that, when it's done in this group fashion, isn't it quite possible for a defendant, by an oversight, to fail to object? And that certainly would be a forfeiture rather than a waiver.
I don't think in this case, particularly since Judge Stadmiller required the joint pretrial report, which required the parties to discuss and agree about jury instructions and to discuss the disputed one. At the final pretrial conference on April 1st, he directed the parties to go back and discuss further the instructions that were disputed, and both parties filed a memorandum subsequent to that regarding the disputed instructions. This instruction still wasn't.
What happens after that, Ms. Green? It isn't obviously the final pretrial conference, because if you're sent back to do something else, that bespeaks a subsequent conference. So then, did you reappear in court after what you labeled the final pretrial conference, where he directed you to go and continue trying to work out the dispute?
We filed memorandums.
And in that memorandum, if we are to look at that, will we find specific objections to specific instructions by both sides?
Yes, you will.
And everyone that is not specifically objected to, is there any sort of representation that all others are not objected to? Or is that all to be read into because of the...
I think if you look at both the joint final pretrial report and its enumeration of the instructions that are subject to disagreement and the memorandums that were filed, I believe on April 4th, that you will find that there was a meeting of the minds with respect to those instructions that were not subject to the agreement. And I guess, yes, by implication, there's no other way to interpret this.
Is that the practice generally in the courts in the Eastern District?
Actually, I think that Judge Stadmiller is more particular in terms of eliciting information from the parties about their positions on jury instructions.
No, I mean the practice of specifically objecting to or approving of each instruction, where you stand before the judge, or in chambers if you do it on the record, where you stand before the judge and you go through each instruction, and that's my understanding of an instruction conference, and record objections to the specific ones. This kind of wholesale approach, I'm just not familiar with.
Well, I guess I am telling the court that I believe that that's what we did.
Oh, I'm not questioning what you did.
Read each. He didn't say first page. I don't know that he numbered them even. But we had the instructions, and he had us go through them, and he asked for input on the instructions. You know, positive, negative, or whatever. What is there something you want changed? Is there something that you object to? And if you look at that jury instruction conference, there was not a lot of discussion, but some discussion.
What was an example of a forfeiture that was not a waiver of an instruction, of an objection to an instruction?
I think perhaps if the first time it came up at a jury instruction conference and a defendant failed to object to something that he had not seen before, or that was first presented to him.
Not seen before?
Well, in this case, this defendant.
That would be forfeiture, obviously.
Well, sure it would. If he sees this instruction for the first.
Seen it? How could you be thought to have forfeited an objection to something you'd never seen? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, perhaps I misspoke.
Yes.
Well, he gave us the instructions that he intended to give, he being Judge Stadmiller. We reviewed them. And when
I would ask you for an example of a forfeiture of an objection to an instruction that you would not deem a waiver.
And I'm trying to articulate this, Your Honor.
You can't think of it. Because, as I say, to object to something you've never seen...
Well, I didn't mean never seen. I meant seen for the first time at the instruction conference.
Yeah,
court had handed this out and we read through them, and for the very first time, the defendant was asked to...
So if it's the first time, it's forfeiture, and if it's the second time, it's waiver. Is that what you're saying?
I think that some of the cases that this court has decided say that.
See
that
what a complicated inquiry you're asking us to make.
Well, I don't think so.
The minds, this, that.
I don't think so. I think there's multiple...
Precisely. Looking multiple things.
In this record.
Not worth it, really, I don't think.
Well...
Worth it.
Ms. Kraft, if the presiding judge will allow me one more question.
Of course.
You said the judge gave us his instructions. In this case, when that first conference, I think you mentioned March was the first conference, does the judge present an initial packet and you supplement it, or is this a submission by both sides of the proposed instructions?
The joint pretrial report required that each side propose instructions.
Right, so they're submitted by both sides.
An attempt to agree on them.
Well,
and identify
that.
Those which were not the subject of agreement. And then after the April 1st, final pretrial conference in court, the judge directed the parties to go back and discuss further the disputed instructions. There were a number of disputed instructions. This instruction was never in dispute.
Yes, we know that.
All right, now one last, if I may. When the instructions were given at trial,
yes,
did there come a time subsequent to the giving before deliberation started where the judge called upon both sides to make any comment with regard to the instructions, or does he not follow that practice?
Before or after the instructions that were given?
Before they're given. After they're given.
You know, I don't recall whether in this case this judge said, were there any objections to the way that...
Isn't there a final recordation of objections made by both sides? Or does it just stand on the instructions at that point are given. They're now in the record. The jury has been... tendered those instructions.
Right.
There's no opportunity for either side to...
Well, I'm sure there is an opportunity. I don't recall in this specific case if the judge said, is there anything else, or does the court have, or do the parties have any objections to the way I read the instructions? I know that most courts do that. I know that there were no objections following the instructions.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Kraft. Mr. Camarena, does he have any time? 1 minute? Yeah, do you have anything further?
Yes, Your Honors. Your Honors, there is a very important distinction between waiver and forfeiture, because a waiver would prohibit this honorable court from reviewing.
Right, no, I understand that.
Nevertheless, the government's position urges the court to disregard that distinction and blurs that distinction. Mr. Hamilton would concede that he had opportunities to object to this instruction. Nevertheless, he did not object, and therefore this court will review the challenge now for plain error. I'd also add that the government makes a point and emphasizes that money had been obtained during the evidence showed that money had been obtained. Therefore, the government suggests that in itself would foreclose the possibility of good faith. I'd only like to point out that, again, in the case of the United States versus Bessison, money had already been obtained. The record, that opinion, notes that the defendant conceded that when he deposited checks, he knew that there were not enough funds to pay. Nevertheless, this honorable court did hold that a defense theory that the defendant entertained a reasonable expectation that sufficient funds would be deposited in time to pay would be a valid defense. We would submit that there's not an important distinction between the facts in United States versus Bennison and the facts here.
But he doesn't get any money if there's going to be money in the account before it's presented for payment. He's not going to get away with anything. That's very different.
I understand that, Your Honor. The holding in that case.
I don't understand. In this case, he gets money, and in the check-kiting case, he doesn't get money until it turns out that there's no money covering his checks, right? And if there's still a chance that there's going to be money to cover the check, then he's not going to defraud anybody.
I would submit, Your Honor, that in the United States versus Benison, the defendant in that case would have received funds when the banks cleared those checks.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Cameron. You were appointed.
Yes, Your Honor.
So we thank you for your vigorous efforts on behalf of your client. We thank Ms. Kraft also.